Welcome back to the quickest podcast ever, brought to you by Kohl's.
Today's topic, fall style.
Wait, wasn't it just June?
Right? So I went to Kohl's.
Of course you did.
I got a cute Cara Santana for Nine West sweater for 25% off and a great pair of Vans.
Love Vans.
And saved 25% on a Champion hoodie for my husband.
Ooh, sounds cozy.
You should go. You'll get 15% off or 15, 20, or even 30% off with a Kohl's card.
BRB.
Select styles. Offers end September 26th. Champion coupons do not apply. Some exclusions apply. See store or Kohl's.com for details.
Right. Hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of Minority Report's podcast and digital series. I am your host, Mona Sheikh. Sometimes my live stream says that it's still going, and then later I look at it and it's like, no, you were live for like 30 seconds, and it always does that. So I don't know, not always, but sometimes it does that. So anyways, I am very excited because A, it's Friday. B, I am vaccinated. And C, I'm vaccinated. I'm very happy. So there's a lot more freedom that I have. And I'm very excited about my guest because I messed up the date because I thought I had him last week. But the truth is that I have him this Friday. And I am happy that it's this Friday and not last Friday. But anyways, my guest today is an amazing producer and director, and he has directed The Walking Dead. He's been a director on the 9-1-1, and I'm going to have him, we're going to talk about his career and his journey to being a producer and director. Here's the very talented Shoutout Raju. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? I'm glad to make the list of from Vaccination Friday and then talking to me.
Vaccination Friday. Did you get vaccinated yet?
No, not yet. I tried to wait in line somewhere to be on standby, and I waited about 4 hours. I didn't get it. So, but in a couple weeks, I think. Yeah.
Oh, man. I heard that when is it opening in California? Is it May 1st?
I heard April 1st for 50 and over, and then April 15th for 16 and over. So basically everyone after that. I think it's basically April, mid-April.
Yeah. Okay, mid-April. All right. Are you more a two-shot kind of guy, or are you a one-shot kind of guy?
You know, give me whatever's available.
Just jab me already. Just freaking jab me.
Let's just end it, whatever it is.
Well, thank you for being here. And I wanted to kind of take a moment and ask you about how, as a producer and a director, have you been working during the pandemic, or has it been crickets?
Yeah, so a year ago when everything shut down, I was directing a show that ended right before, like around February. And then in March, everything shut down. Like the whole film industry shut down. So I was... I was supposed to go to do a show in April, and then they postponed because no one at that time knew, like, maybe things would come back. And so no one's really certain. And then the whole industry at large just said, we have to figure out how to work safely. So then all last summer, the studios and the unions all got together they created a white paper. They did a lot of research and a lot of talk with public health officials to figure out, you know, how one can operate a show or a film set safely, because you're in very close proximity with a lot of people. I mean, if you work on a major television show, it's 150 people on a set, right. And as a director, you have to get very close to people. And the actors are the most vulnerable because they don't have masks and they're going to be interacting, right. And they have to actually, you know, be very close to each other, very intimate. So it's they had to develop some kind of system and how to work. So that took basically all of summer, and then around August, maybe September, then things started to reopen. Like they had a plan in place. They started to implement it. So shows started up again. Movies started shooting again. And it's been hit or miss. I mean, I started up again and in December. I started working on a show in December, and up and through now, I've been working on a show. So that's what I've been doing. I mean, for the most part, I was running a preschool and daycare, nonprofit in my home for about 10 months. That was my primary mode of employment. We had a lot of staff revolt, but that was a
wait a minute. Basically, this nonprofit child support, this daycare at home. Is this, are you referring to your own kids? Are you referring to other people's kids?
No, that's my kids. It was unplanned. But that was what a lot of us had to do. So now things are, there's still a pandemic. There's still, possible transmission and infections, but there's a whole series of protocols. Like I have to go test 3 times a week and they have different tiers. Like if you're in a certain zone, then if you're like in zone A, that means you're the ones who can be close to the actors. So the actor, everything else sort of revolves around protecting the actors because they're the only ones who can't have masks when they're working.
That's
so correct. If you're within contact of them, you're part of this tier that has to be, assured that you have no infection. Even then, like shows have routinely had to shut down. I mean, even the shows I've worked on had to shut down. Someone gets sick on some part. Some of the crews also segmented. So like you could, if some part of like the art department gets sick on a show that only works in the office, you can quarantine them and then keep working. But some shows have had to shut down completely. I've had a lot of friends they had to shut down. They had to quarantine themselves for 2 weeks and then restart. And so it's been a very strange thing. And also then when I'm working now, I have had to wear a mask and shield while I'm directing, right. Which is sort of a weird thing to do when you have to talk to an actor or talk to crew. Right. So, but anyway, it's good that they figured out a way to do it, but it's very strange.
Wow. I mean, in a way, you can also kind of, once everybody gets vaccinated, you can also kind of start like a side hustle of a daycare because now you're really good at it.
I would debate whether I'm good at it. You'd have to ask the family. I don't know if I'm good at it.
If the kids are breathing and they're eating and they're happy, I think you've done a good job.
Happy? We'll see.
really, who the hell is happy right now, Sharad? Please do tell. Besides Elon Musk and freaking Jeff Bezos, who's happy? Please do tell.
That's right. That's true. That's true. You're right.
I mean, 400% increase. I mean, in wealth, like that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's not the same for artists. I honestly, Sharad, I'm a stand-up comic and I tour around the world and I lost like almost like 90-95% of my income. It's just disappeared.
Sure. Oh yeah.
It just left. I mean, I heard that in New York City, like 2/3 of artists have like pretty much left town. They've lost all their jobs. So, and you're just like, wow, how is Broadway going to survive? Like, what is going to happen? I mean, this pandemic, have you had like any like spiritual epiphanies during the pandemic where you're just like, man?
Well, I mean, gosh, I must have had many. I'm trying to, it does make you realize how fragile the whole system is, because if suddenly then you can't do the things that either, provide you with source of resources and means, and then you can't also do the thing you love, like what do you do? I mean, a lot of people some people were very resourceful who were able to like do things like this, like create a podcast or create something that they can do from home, or they could do, some people made like films with in their house with the people they live with, so some people are very resourceful. I mean, a lot of people were writing. Like I was trying to do as much writing as I could. Like I tried to take an opportunity to do that. But then, like if you have a family, if you suddenly don't have people to come who can come over we couldn't have our caretakers come over for a long time. And we usually have, grandparents, my parents or my wife's parents live with us usually. And they all went away. So, we all had to adjust. So I think the biggest thing is sort of realize like, oh, how everything is sort of connected. And if you pull out the rug, then you see like, oh, everything is dependent on a series of very delicately balanced things that if you pull one out, then like, everything kind of crumbles. So so it's a lot of the epiphany, just sort of appreciating just how, delicately balanced everything is.
Right. Right. I feel like also how fragile life is, right? We make all these plans, we put in all this work, we're just like, oh, I'm going to achieve this and I'm going to do that. And then, you know, one virus can come along and be like, let me stop you right there. That's right. Not going to work. And you're like, oh, shit, you could just die. I mean, I have at least 4 people I know personally that have died due to COVID. I mean, it's pretty bad, right? Or people that I, you know, whose parents have died. I mean, it's pretty bad. But I wanted to actually get to know about your journey to being a producer and a director. Were you, did you start off as an actor and then transition into being a producer director, or your that was not the case?
I am not. I am behind the camera. No, I am not. I'm certainly, I had no desire or talent to be an actor. No, I'm, you know, like, I have immigrant parents. We, like a lot of us, my parents came from India. My parents are from Bangalore and Mysore, South Indian. And I mean, I grew up in Chicago. I didn't grow up around the film industry. So, I mean, I had some sense that films were made by people. I didn't know, like, one can go into the film industry. Just sort of like you go to the farmer and you go to the grocery store and eat and pick an apple. You don't really think about the farmer and the person who picked the apple. You just sort of think, like you go to the movie theater to watch a movie. You don't really think about all the people or that one can go make movies. But I came from a family that had a literary tradition. My grandfather was a famous poet in the kind of the language, and my Gopal Krishnadiga and my dad and mom were both always, my dad writes fiction and nonfiction. And we had grew up in sort of a literary family tradition. Mm-hmm. So when I went to college and I kind of always knew that I wanted to be a writer. I wrote the school news, at the student newspaper. I was a writing major and I started making film projects and I just fell in love with it. And directing is sort of, to me, writing in 3 dimensions, and you get to, where you get to move in space and actors and music, and the whole thing is like creating a book, but like it to life. And so I just fell in love with it and I just didn't want to do anything else. So then I figured, you know, I wanted to learn more. I made some very bad projects in college and I was like, I wanted to get better. So I knew I would, you know, wanted to go to graduate film school. So I moved out to LA and I started, I was an assistant. I got a job in the industry while I was applying to film schools, and I was a casting assistant to one of the top casting directors in the world, Mally Finn. And so I worked on the Matrix sequels and 8 Mile and other movies and TV shows. So I got to see, I mean, I was an assistant, so I had a very small role in all of those, but I got to see a lot of actors come in and perform. So I got to learn a lot about performance. And then I got into the American Film Institute's directing program. And at AFI, my film coming out of AFI was American Made, which had Cal Penn and Bernie White and Sakina Jaffrey. And that was my first film that went out into the world. And that won a couple dozen awards. And it was ended up being broadcast on television. It sort of started my career. But even then, like, your career as a filmmaker is sort of like in ups and downs. You know, I spent probably about 10 years as a independent filmmaker, sort of scrapping together a living, you know, writing scripts for people sometimes, making some projects sometimes, getting a little bit, you know, a little funding for a project here, a little funding for a project here. And all this while I was still, you know, trying to make my own projects, bigger projects and breaking into television. And then finally, you know, I got into some directing programs at the networks, ABC and NBC and Sony Pictures, and they have you sort of shadow on television shows. So in NBC, I shadowed on Law & Order SVU, which shoots in New York. And so after I shadowed there, they gave me an episode that went well. They gave me a second episode, and then I sort of just started directing television. So for the last 7 years, I've directed about almost 35 episodes of television. So and then TV, most people, not a lot of people know, I guess not everyone knows this, but TV, there's a different director per episode. So
that's right.
A season of television, you know, they may have 10 different directors. So sort of go from show to show.
Why do they do that, Sharath? Why different directors for every episode? Why?
Sure. So the reason is, in a production calendar, the thing that's expensive is shoot days, like actually physically production days. That's the most expensive thing. So to make that the most efficient and to truncate that, they have to do things at the same time. So one director is prepping to shoot one director is shooting and one director is in post editing their episode. And then, so there's three directors sort of working at once. So like while I'm, so let's say I'm doing episode two is shooting and episode four is getting their script and episode one is editing. So like everything is sort of happening, you know, and it's a big, for network shows, they're big machines. Now there's some shows like some limited series and some things like True Detective and things like that, that have one director does the whole thing. Those are like, you know, for 5-10 miniseries, that type style. But generally speaking, that's sort of like, you know, so a lot of people like me who, you know, have our own projects, the thing that, so we do sort of as a living is directing, guest directing on shows, but also, you know, at the same time, you're trying to make our own projects. So that's sort of like, that's been generally my journey. I also make documentaries with my wife, Valerie Corr. And so we made, we also ran a documentary program at Yale Law School for a couple of years. So I kind of work in both the fiction and nonfiction, but mostly for the last 6 years, I've been doing television mostly.
Got it. I mean, you know, I'm listening to you and I'm wondering to myself, as an artist, I can tell you that the struggle is you know, do odd jobs, you wait tables, you do office gigs. What kind of gigs does a director or a producer take to scrap together to get his career going?
Probably the same type of things. I mean, you know, my first job, although I was a casting assistant, I was, you know, I was basically an office job. But yeah, a lot of directors, I mean, you know, once, it depends, like if you, it depends where you come from as a director. Some directors come from like a very technical camera background. So like if you have knowledge in the camera department, you could probably intern, or you mean you could probably get a job working as a camera assistant. Or if you I have a lot of friends who were editors or then became editors after graduating from the directing program. And because editing requires a technical skill that if you've trained as an editor, you can also be an editorial assistant or you can work in something in the office. So those are jobs that if you have the skill set, you can do it. I mean, there's also like, you know, nowadays the barriers to making something are so low. I mean, we have like a movie studio in our phone now. I mean, you know, you can shoot and edit something that is, you can always kind of create something. I mean, a lot of directors, you know, try to do like small commercials, but you know, for the most part, like if you're just starting out, you're basically doing the same. You're probably being an assistant, or maybe you are a barista or something.
Right.
It's very similar as an artist, like, you know, and then you maybe on the weekends work on your own projects or, you know, so it's I think it's similar to how an actor or a stand up or someone would have to be.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it takes a while, right? Like you can go to school and like you have your project and you're like, all right, hopefully people will see it. But that's not a guarantee that now you're going to be signed with a studio to be like, here's a 5-movie deal. Sharath, here you go. It's not like that. It's such a topsy-turvy mercurial business where you're just like, I don't know where the next paycheck is coming from. I don't know what's happening. Mm-hmm. Unless you kind of hit that kind of, you know, over the top where you're like an M. Night Shyamalan and then you're like, oh shit. But even M. Night gets put in director jail, right? That's a real thing too. Who determines that you go in the director's jail and how long do they determine that you stay there?
Oh, well, I don't know. I guess it depends on if it's maximum security or minimum security, I suppose.
You haven't been in it, I can tell.
On the level of felony. No, I don't know if I've been in director jail, but I definitely have. I mean, it took me 7 years from when I got into it. I mean, okay, so it took me about 10 years as an independent filmmaker before I started to really make a name for myself or like people to recognize, like give me an opportunity on the higher level. So it takes about a decade. I mean, it took me seven years from my first, when I first was in the first directing program to when I actually got an episode of television. So it's who determines, but like, I guess, are you asked who determines, like, it's hard, you won't get hired if you've screwed up? Because I feel like that's what happens with M. Night. I think you may have gotten, some people get in director's jail because their box office didn't do well. I mean, his director's jail is great. I mean, he's already very successful.
That's right.
I mean,
like, that's right. Yeah. He'll be fine, Sharath. We don't have to worry about him.
Yeah, he'll be fine. I mean, it's different for like, you know, who determines, I guess if the question is then instead, or similarly, who determines how you get started? Well, that is the question. No one really knows. I mean, it's a combination of your own work. It's and also then luck, opportunity, hard work, you know, all of these things have to kind of like, and for me, like, you know, even to get my first episode of television, like I had a producer who said I was shadowing on Boston Legal. And this producer said, I want to hire you next season. We don't know if we're getting renewed. If we get renewed, I'm going to hire you in the second half of the season. I'm like, oh, that's great. And this was 2008. And then they got canceled. They got renewed for half a season. So then he couldn't hire me. But, you know, so then he had a show. A year later, he had another show on NBC called Harry's Law. And he said, okay, if we get a season two, we'll get you an episode of season two. They got canceled. so that's not like I did anything wrong. And
right.
It's like, you know, but I still had these people who are sort of supporting me. So like, if it happened, it worked out, you know, if all these things lined up, then maybe I'll, you know, get that. So it's some combination of like quality of work, hard work, luck. And then you need to have mentors. You need to have people who support you. And even in the film industry, even though it's big and vast, there are people who want to help the new upcoming filmmakers. So right. you just finally find those people and stick with them. That's part of it.
I'm going to draw a parallel to stand-up comedy. In stand-up comedy, it is hard, especially if you're a female comic. It's hard to find mentors. It's not, it's a different world. I think in filmmaking, it's like, well, you know, as a director or producer, you're like, you know, I might not be good for the job, but I think you might be good for the job. So why don't you take it? You know, or let me refer you. But in stand-up, it isn't like that. It is, you know, just like it is for actors. It's very competitive. So you're just like, if I'm getting a gig, I'm getting a gig. I'm not really, unless you're really good friends with the other comic, which I have done, where I'm like, hey, I'm out of town. Why don't you take this gig? You know? Or you, and the people have done that to me. So we kind of look out for each other. But as far as like finding mentors, it always seems to be this challenging task to find a mentor. And I have a writing mentor. I don't really necessarily have a stand-up mentor. However, I'm a mentor to three other female comics because they come to me and I'm a mentor to them, but I've never had a mentor. So I just had to pretty much fall on my face and learn stuff and be like, oh, don't do that shit again. And then just like, carry on with your life, you know? But for you, have your mentors been people that they were like a little ahead of you. You went on a set and they were a director and you were just like, oh my God, this person's amazing. How do you turn them into your mentor? You're like, hey, can I buy you coffee? Can I buy you dinner? Like whatever you can afford. Yeah. How does that even go?
Yeah. I mean, it's gotta be hard as a stand up because your job is you. You are the job. Like, you know, it's just you, right? Like, film is so collaborative. There's so many. Right. Even though as a director, it's not, there's no film just about the director. You know, the director is one part, is leading the ship, but there's a lot of people rowing. So, so for me, the people who have been mentors to me have been, because I was in these these programs at these networks at ABC and NBC and Sony. And those programs basically are mentorship programs. So then I would be on a show where I would shadow a director while they made it. So I was like on Desperate Housewives. And so I shadowed a director named David Grossman. And he then, so I could just, I was basically a fly on the wall while he was making the episode. And I could ask him questions and, you know, and really watch him work. And then just stay in touch with him. And sort of that's just the way it kind of happened. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to mentor because they had seen my work. And they, I guess, you know, I didn't do anything objectionable when I was around them. So they were okay with having me around. So that's sort of how it works. And film is like that because, I mean, there are producers, I mean, on the feature film side of things, there are producers who like finding the next young talent. So that's the other thing too. Mm. I mean, maybe something like that too, but like there's always this desire to find like who has a new and interesting voice. I mean, that's a certain segment of the industry. A lot of it is like that. And so that means like, you know, this person tells a story in a different way or comes from an interesting background. We want to make sure that's showcased. So there are people, there are producers who do that too. Like, you know, Brad Pitt has a A24, which is, you know, one of the best independent film studios out there that made Moonlight, you know, and made made this year Minari. So they make like, so there are people who are, you know, established who want to bring along the younger filmmakers. So the film industry does have that as well. But you got to find those people. Yeah, that's a question. How do you find somebody? There are people who, you know, reach out to me and ask me for advice, and I try to help, like, same like you're saying, as best I can. And some of these people who I've developed relationships with went on to then go on to shows in which they can hire me. So then there's also that aspect, which maybe they could. So that's sort, like, of it.
I mean, you're would you consider yourself more of a director than a producer, or would you say that's more like 50-50, 80-20, or you're more of a director than a producer?
I'm more of a director. Yeah, I mean, the producing side, I have produced because I've made, especially when I make smaller projects, but producing is tough because that's really like kind of the nuts and bolts and the financial side and all the stuff that is, you know, related to the creative side. I like to be the one creating the story. You know, not to be that said, I'm, you know, developing and producing a film that someone else is going to direct. I do do both, but I'd say I would call myself a director. I'd say more director and writer than producer. Yeah.
I mean, sure. Like, what's your kind of ultimate goal? Like, what's your, are you writing your own projects that you want to direct, and then it gets nominated for an Oscar and you're like, I've made it, Mom. Like, how, you know, what is the kind of ultimate for you to be like, you know what? I mean, like, at what point do you say to yourself, you know what?
Still hoping to go to medical school.
Still hoping to medical school, yeah. Believe me, I missed a call from my mom today, too. She was trying to push me for the same thing. Actually, she's just trying to push me to get married at this point. So I'm just like, that's you got to pick, lady. That's either medical school or marriage. It can't be both. You got to pick one. It can't be, can't be pushing
both. Marry a doctor and you get both, really.
Just marry a doctor. Just get over it. They're all taken. There's also that. You said you grew up in Chicago, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Why is it that every time, two of my dear, dear friends are from Chicago. Why is it that every time I come across folks from Chicago, they're just like the nicest people? What's in the water in Chicago, Shara?
There are some mean people in Chicago. I know that.
I don't want to meet them. I don't want to
meet them. We raise kind people. I don't know. There are a lot of those. I guess Midwestern folk can be very kind. So I don't, maybe there's something to that. But to answer your previous question, I'm basically, you know, I just want to make and create the things that I find either moving or interesting and be able to show it to people. I mean, really, that's my only goal. I mean, I've always had a vision of a career that's where I get to sort of direct television and make movies at the same time. So I've sort of made the directing side, the TV side happen. I'm still kind of working on making the movie side happen. So that's sort of it. But, you know, I have a pretty good life. I mean, I get to make-believe all the time.
Right, absolutely.
Someone thinks that someone has believed that to be an actual career. So, and then they'll compensate me for it, which I would do it. If they didn't know, I would do it for free. But it's really, I mean, very few people get to do the thing that they love as the thing that also is their main way of making a living. And so I'm really grateful that I get to be one of those people.
Yeah. I mean, for me, Sharath, I mean, I can tell you, like, when I moved from Pakistan at the age of 15, you know, stand-up comedy was not a thing. Like, it's not, like, first of all, Pakistani girls don't become stand-up comics. Like, let's get one thing very clear here. Even Pakistani dudes don't become stand-up comics, let alone a woman. So that's just like, I remember
Just Kumail. It's only Kumail.
I remember watching David Letterman late night show for the first time when I had just moved from Pakistan. And I remember watching it and being like, why is everybody laughing? Why is this funny? Because I didn't have the cultural references to understand why it was funny. Sure. And I just kind of made it this thing for myself where I was like, I'm going to figure out why this is funny. Like what he says every night, why is that funny? Like, I want to know. And mm-hmm. for me to even go into stand up and actually even make a living at it today is like this bizarre thing. It's like, this was not something that I envisioned. But for you, did you envision yourself starting off as a writer and then just kind of were like, oh no, being a director or producer is more my thing than writer?
Boy, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I ever even thought so far. I always thought I'd be a novelist. I mean, that's why when I was in college and growing up, you know, I was a double major. I was in writing, but I also was taking science classes because I grew up although we had a literate family, my father is a physician and his father was a physician. So we had also that part of our, so I grew up all around, like a lot of South Asians grew up around a lot of doctors, but I also knew that I loved writing.
That's shocking. We never hear that kind of stuff.
I know, very shocking. And when I went to college, I thought for sure I'd go to graduate school to get my MFA in creative writing and write novels. And then movies just felt like they were writing novels, like I was saying, in like three dimensions. So yeah, I don't know if I am. I never really knew. Even when I moved to LA, I would meet people who told me they're making a movie, and there's like people who I knew. I was like, "What does that mean? How can you make a movie?" And then I found out like people actually can, like they had a vision, they were raising money for it, they were getting cast, they were getting all the resources to hire a crew, and then they were making a movie. I was like, blew my mind, like, oh my gosh, one can make a movie. So even when I got here, when I was just out of college, I was pretty. It was shocking that the people can just do that. Like it was actually, you can create something. So it took me a while to really, really comprehend that. This is something you can do.
Right. Like it's an actual reality to be able to go and raise funding, write a project and then shoot it and get it made. That's
have a dream to make something and go do it. As opposed to, right. I always thought like maybe, someone, you have to ask someone, they'd have to say yes. Yeah. Some people just say, no, this is the thing I'm going to make. And then I'm going to find the way to do it.
Right.
Kind of the great thing about filmmaking.
Yeah. I mean, sure. In the past, I would say past 5 to 10 years, this whole conversation about diversity and representation has really amped up in Hollywood. Like, it's a big conversation. I mean, when I approached the Comedy Store about 6-7 years ago, when I launched this, my Minority Reports, which is now a podcast also, I remember approaching them and being like, hey, I want to produce a show called Minority Reports and I want to showcase people like myself because we don't get booked on your regular lineups. Like, you don't have room for us, right? We don't have a voice. And they were like, yeah, great. And I started doing the show, but now more than ever before, there's all this talk about representation in front of camera, but I think there's a conversation that's happening about representation behind the camera and not just in directors and producers, but also on executive level, because people who are the decision makers who are going to give the green light to cut the check, those people also need to be diverse. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think that probably remains the biggest barrier is that the people who have access to money or to make the big decisions are still mostly not people of color or women.
That's right.
So, I mean, it's changing. It continues to change and the industry does try its hardest, but that's the biggest, it's hard to imagine the value. Like if you can't understand the value of a person of color story, then why would you give money to it? Like, why would you fund it? So that part changes. I mean, there's always people of color who are talented behind the camera. I mean, the pipeline to getting more has to be expanded as well. Like, I have to make sure that people know that it's a viable career. But it's the decision makers that need to change. And TV keeps doing better and better at it. I mean, film is a little bit behind. But I mean, this year, there's positive signs. I mean, you see the Oscars this year. We have, two Asian American directors that are nominated, Minari is nominated for Best Picture. I mean, it's really last year, it's not an American film, but Parasite won best yes. first time ever a foreign language film won Best Picture Oscar. So, it continues. That doesn't mean things have changed, but things are getting better. I mean, even like when I moved here, I moved to LA 21 years ago. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's crazy.
That's a long time.
And And when I got here, I mean, there was like so few of us that we all kind of knew each other.
Right.
Even between a degree of separation, like I felt like I knew every filmmaker. I think I did, because there weren't that many. And this is like this is the anniversary of the following really, you know, rugged independent films that got made. ABCD, American Desi, American Chai, all kind of came out around the same time. And there are these hardcore little independent films that people just made. And then Chutney Popcorn, which came a couple years before that. They were all sort of like the first wave of this, of like my generation as filmmakers making films. And that was it. I mean, there were so few. The only one who was really successful was M. Night Shyamalan, who just made Sixth Sense and was just becoming well known. And that was, but he was already on a different plane. So that was a different kind of thing. But like, there were so few South Asians back then that it never even occurred to me that one would be interested in South Asian story and Indian story, because you didn't see him on television. And then, like, you know, fast forward to now, it's totally changed. I mean, we've had like, there was a whole show a few years ago called, you know, Outsourced, right? That had like all this entire Indian cast. It wasn't a great show, and it was based on the independent film, but like it happened, like it actually happened. And that was even before this current wave where we were having great shows like Superstore, which just got canceled, and other stores that are really, and then like, you know, Fresh Off the Boat and all these really great shows that have people of color that are really, really surprising. Yeah.
Did Superstore get canceled?
We did it again. Verizon was just named America's most reliable network by RootMetrics for the 16th time in a row, proving once again that nobody builds networks like Verizon builds networks. That's why we're building 5G right. That's why there's only one best network, Verizon. Best and most reliable based on RootMetrics reports from second half 2013 to first half 2021 of three operators on all network types combined, not specific to 5G networks.
In 2020, we all miss seeing friends and loved ones. With the U.S. Bank Altitude Connect Visa Signature Card, it's easy to reconnect again. Earn 5x points on prepaid hotels and car rentals booked directly in the Altitude Rewards Center. Earn 4x points on travel and at gas stations. 2x points on groceries, dining, and streaming services. Plus, get 50,000 bonus points when you spend $3,000 within the first 120 days. That's a $500 value. Learn more at usbank.com/altitudeconnect. The U.S. Bank Altitude Connect Visa Signature Card is issued by U.S. Bank National Association, ND. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
Final season, I don't know if it's his final season coming up or if it's – or how – it just announced a few days ago,
You know, one thing that I've noticed, Sharath, is that that's changed, especially in the past 5 years in casting, is that now casting directors, studios, directors, producers are no longer like – oh, are you kind of brown looking? We'll cast you as a Saudi person. And it's like, well, I'm not a Saudi person, right? I'm not fluent in Arabic. Like I can pick up Arabic because I grew up with speaking Urdu, and you know, I have command of like five languages, but that's a different, but I'm saying if you don't, like, not everybody's just being like, oh, you're Latino looking. Oh, maybe you can pass for an Indian. Let's just cast you as that. It's no longer that. There's a lot more understanding. There's a lot more getting rid of ignorance to be like, hey, you know, South Asia is not the Middle East. Like, let's be clear, right? You know, there are different Latin countries. Not everybody who comes from Latin America is Mexican. Like, these kind of, you know, nuanced conversations, this kind of, you know, separating and being like, okay, this person is from India. This person is from so-and-so. Like, just kind of that understanding. I recently, not recently, but last December, I auditioned for the show called The Rookie on ABC with Nathan Fillion. And the interesting thing about this audition was that it was for a role for a Persian woman, right? And Persian, wealthy Persian woman. So I remember looking at the sides, I'm like, do they want me to do an accent on this? And I'm like, fuck that. I'm not doing an accent. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to talk like the way I talk. You know, and I ended up booking the job, and I was really surprised. And I was like, oh, how interesting. They're no longer pushing you to, you know, I've been in auditions, Sharath, where they're like, can you do like the Indian accent? Can you like put it on? And then, you know, you do it and they're like, can you put it on a little bit more? And you're like, what, do you want me to be fucking Apu from Simpsons? Like, what do you want, right? But I feel like when you're a director or a producer or somebody in your position, like in the past 7 years, you had this whole thing about diversity and representation. Do you feel you have been getting a lot more gigs because of it? Have more opportunities come in for you because of it? Or is that still pretty sparse?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know that like the shows are, TV shows are trying to, so every year the Directors Guild puts out a report of the shows hiring, how many people of color they hired. And women, and they have a whole percentage breakdown, and it's like a little bit of a shaming report because there's a lot of shows that have 0%, and so we're like 10% or 5%.
What shows are those, Sharat? Do you want to share what shows are those?
I don't remember. It changed. I mean, every year sort of changes. I remember it's like there's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and a couple, and some of those shows, because they hire so few directors because they have a smaller order, they may only have a few. So like, to be fair to those shows, they may only hire 5 directors.
God.
To be unfair, to be accurate, those 5 still are probably all white men, so that's also a problem.
Sure.
Shows are trying to. So, have I gotten jobs because I'm Indian? It probably helps now. I mean, it does probably, because shows. I know they need to show that they're hiring people from as many backgrounds as they can, and a lot of shows are very good at it. And I think the shows have also realized that it benefits the show to not have everyone be the same type of person. I mostly get hired because people like having me direct their shows, but I think it doesn't hurt the fact that I'm also a person of color to help tick off a box for them. And there are a lot of shows that are trying this initiative where they hire 50% of their directors are women. So Ryan Murphy Productions has a whole thing called the Half Initiative, where they want half of their directors to be, it's either women and people of color or just women, but I think it's women and people of color. So it's good. I mean, these are all good. I mean, this is what we want. So it's changed for sure. I don't know how many, I mean, but in terms of casting, which is interesting, I mean, that has changed. Like I'm really impressed with how casting has changed, because it is, when I was working on Grimm, the show Grimm, and we had a storyline with a Japanese family, and they were adamant about hiring a Japanese, actual Japanese American, and not someone who could play Japanese. And I was very impressed. I was like, which is what I would ask for too. And I would have said we should have someone who's actually Japanese, not just someone generally East Asian. And so shows are getting the specific. They're drilling, and it's good.
It makes a big difference because you see authenticity, right? Like when you watch Kumail Nanjiani in The Big Sick, you know, even like some Pakistanis had a problem, but you know, I guess you can't make everybody happy. But some people were like, well, that's not how our Pakistani families discuss. I'm like, well, but you might be generalizing to say that every Pakistani family behaves the same way. That there are different people in different cultures and ethnicities, so you can't really generalize that. But do you think that it brings more authenticity to the project than just hiring somebody possibly just East Asian looking and being like, hey, yeah, you can just come play this role?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it does. It also thinks it feels like, you know, you're doing, if you're going to tell a story with a person of color or a minority in it, then, you know, get it right. You know, like,
right.
You know, we had a whole thing. So my wife is, you know, sick. She's a sick American. And so she has been working with studios to make sure they cast sick characters in any roles, just small roles, as long as they just are, you know, just, and to help them get it right. So like, so the Sick Coalition, which is a legal and advocacy organization, partners with studios, so they can help them, because like the costume and wardrobe people don't know how to tie a turban. They may not, they won't know that sick, you know, motive. And so to get that all right, they have, you know, they offer for free consultants to these shows. And, you know, and still some shows have gotten it wrong. They didn't tie a turban right, or they didn't do whatever they did wrong. But there's a lot of them that did it well. Like This Is Us, partly through this partnership, hired, they just cast a guy that who just worked at a hardware store, and he happened to be just a turban wearing sardar, you know, he was just a sick. And he was just worked at like a Home Depot, just an ordinary person. But he had a very meaningful scene with one of the main characters. And it would never have happened. I mean, had they written someone like that in the previous time, they would have gotten the turban wrong. They would have got the accent wrong. They would have maybe not cast an Indian. They would have done all kinds of things that are wrong. But instead, they got that right. They cast a good actor, and it was a memorable scene. And that's like, that's sort of like the bullseye. Like, if you can do all that right.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. You have kids. You have two?
Mm-hmm. A 6-year-old boy and a 2-year-old girl.
Okay. So the 2-year-old's a little, but the 6-year-old probably understands, probably sees things. And like, does he, get curious about what you and your wife doing? Like, daddy, like, what are you doing? Like, what is, like, what do you do? Like, can you take me to work? What do you do?
Well, before COVID, I mean, he had probably before the age of 4 had visited more film sets than I had before the age of 25. I mean, because anytime I had a job in town, they would come and visit. So, so he's seen it, and he understands like the making of fiction. And so when I'm working, I'll sometimes film something from behind the scenes of how we're doing something, especially if it's a complicated stunt or some kind of effect. And so I'll come home and show him. Because it's pretty neat sometimes. I mean, we just had a thing I filmed last Friday for a show. We had a whole car racing sequence like on the streets. Wow. And so, we had kids driving, like, you know, minors, they weren't actually able to drive. So we had to figure out a way to do it. So we have a whole system of a car that goes on top of a platform. And anyway, so I filmed all that and showed him when I came home. And I think he thinks it's fun enough. He thinks it's kind of cool. I think, you know, he doesn't watch any of the shows I make because they're not for kids really.
Sure.
But he did. We had in the episode of 911 Lone Star I directed last year. It was a whole tornado thing, and we had a car that gets swept up by this tornado and stuck between two buildings upside down. So I showed him images of when we were filming it, and then I showed him the final version of it because it's pretty cool. So yeah, I sort of do that. He's going to go to medical school, so it doesn't matter.
That was going to be my next question, so I guess I can just skip right over that question. You're like, but he's going to film school, but he's going to medical school. No, anyways.
This is much too hard.
You're like, he's like, daddy, I want to go to film school. You're like, beta, you mean medical school. That's what you mean.
You're going to medical school.
You mean, I want to be an actor. You mean doctor? It's the same OR at the end. If your kid wants to become a director or a producer tomorrow, would you encourage them?
No, because he's only 7. You'll be 7. So, no, it's too young. You mean the future? Oh, okay.
Not tomorrow. That's too early.
Yeah.
Schools aren't even open, man. Schools aren't even open right now.
Yeah, you can't go tomorrow. No. I would. I mean, if he did it because he knew it's something he loves and he wants to tell stories, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's different because like it's different than my parents said, you know, they had trust, faith in me that I would make a not reckless decision. But they, you know, they didn't know. I mean, they didn't know. They didn't know any other filmmakers. They knew it was risky. They're worried a lot, probably. I mean, for me, I know what he'd be getting into. If he did it, if he wanted to. Now, if he's like said, like, I want to, you know, be a skydiver, I'd be like, I'm a little concerned about that. I mean, maybe let's think about another one, but let's have a backup.
Medical school.
Yeah, medical school. But no, I mean, gosh, if he was able to, wanted to live, either of them wanted to live a life of a life of creativity, that's, it's great. It just would be, have to tell them, these are the things you're going to have to go through.
Right. That's right. That's right. These are, I mean, because it's so hard. If I had a kid tomorrow and my kid's like, I want to be a stand-up comic, I'd be like, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
How you do stand-up comedy seems to me the hardest of all, because it is nakedly you. You're like, you're, and then also you just have to be up on stage. I don't know. That seems like, that to me is way harder than being a director. Let me just tell you.
It is because just like you said, right? Being a director or producer is more of a collaborative thing. I mean, I'm also a producer because I produce all these live shows and I have a TV show and a doc that I'm executive producing as well. But yeah, I mean, I'm also on that side. But yeah, I mean, listen, if you've come from a nice family and your parents were supportive and kind and nice, there's no reason to do stand-up comedy. Don't freaking do stand-up comedy. Don't do it. It's stupid. Like, what are you going to talk about? How nice your family was? Shut up. Who cares? Get out of here. I don't care. Like, tell me the fucked up stories. Tell me how your, you know, dad used to beat the crap out of you. I want to hear those stories. Those are the stories I want to hear because I experienced that shit. So I want you to tell me the fucked up shit. I don't know, man. Stand-up is a dark world. Stand-up is a very, you know, man, God, in the beginning, you know, you were talking about odd jobs and stuff. Like, you know, you do your odd jobs and then you're running open mics where you're standing waiting for like an hour, 2 hours just to do a 3 minute set. Like, that's the life. Yeah. Like, that's the life you've chosen. Like, this is it. You know, this thing about diversity, do you think, I know a lot of people, I know the Latinx community, you're talking about a lot of African Americans, also South Asians have been very vocal about, you know, having diversity and representation. Is it becoming like a tiring conversation at this point where because people are constantly talking about diversity, is it becoming where people are like, all right, we fucking get it. We need it. Like, is there like an exhaustion? Is like a diversity exhaustion happening or am I wrong?
I haven't heard it. I mean, maybe at the hiring level, maybe people are getting tired of it. I don't know. I mean, people don't get tired of money though. I mean, these shows like that are diverse and have like diverse audiences make money. And I think that's the, you know, like why aren't there more shows for the Latino about Latino families on mainstream television? It befuddles me because that feels like those would all make a lot of money. Like or even more shows with African-American family. I mean, so like, I think sure, maybe some people, the people who are most tired about it are probably people who don't understand it, might be just white people. I mean, it could also be, right. I mean, but I haven't, I mean, for as far as I understand, I mean, as far as I've encountered, no one, I've never heard any, I have not heard people who have got diversity fatigue.
Okay, good. Good.
I haven't heard it, but I'm not in a position to hire people. So, you know, who knows?
Got it. I mean, yeah, you're on the director's side, but when you do producing, then you are on the hiring side.
Yeah, I guess. But those are usually my projects. I mean, it's just not something I've personally encountered, but maybe there's people in the executive ranks who are like, didn't we try all this diversity stuff already? Isn't it boring? I don't know. I don't think so, but I think it's proven to be moneymakers.
Right.
You know, the shows, right. You know, if they're good shows and they have a diverse cast, those make money. I mean, This Is Us is one of the most diverse shows out there, and it's a cash cow for NBC. So I don't know.
You're talking about the 911 show?
No, This Is Us.
Us is, yeah. Everybody loves that show. Everybody loves that show. I actually wanted to ask you this thing about, just like you said, why aren't there more shows about, you know, Latino communities? Why aren't there more shows about African America? Because they're cash cows, just like you said. But do you think, on the decision-making level, on the older white dudes that are sitting up there, is there a fear for them to share their power or give up some of their power?
Oh, sure.
To women or to people of color? And what is that fear even validated? Like, that's the part that baffles me, because I'm just like, if you give up some of that power, it's not like you're going to be jobless tomorrow, or you're not going to be able to afford your $30 million yacht. Nobody's coming to take that away from you. Like, you're just sharing your power for more money. That's going to be able to make you buy a $50 million yacht. So that's the part I'm always trying to figure out. I'm like, what is that fear? Is that fear of like, white, you know, the white executives are going to be the minority and that people of color and women are going to be the majority? Like, what is that fear about?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's probably related to power. Like, if you have decision-making authority, if let's say you are the decision-making authority, and then, you know, people around you are telling you that you need to have more voices in the room, and then you get like, you're hiring more diverse voices. And then if you feel then those people now collectively have more power than you, then you feel threatened, probably. I guess I might get threatened to an old power structure, really. I mean, I think that's it. I think it's everyone wants to have their, you know, in the executive level, they want, you know, influence. And if you give up your influence or you give up your power, it feels like you're compromising something. And that's my guess. It's that people probably just don't want to relinquish any control.
Right.
So, you know, that's the same in politics, you know, that's the same in, you know, so many aspects of American culture and sure. life. But yeah, I the money part of it is, you know, if you're already wealthy, you know, if you're not going to be not wealthy, then that is a weird question. That's a question like, why aren't you letting other people in? Right. Because like, they're not suddenly going to take your wealth. They're not taking your wealth. They're sharing it wealth. But like, all of these, especially in entertainment, like a lot of it is, you know, lucrative, very lucrative. And so, you know, people just don't want to cut up that pie into smaller pieces probably. But
Right. I mean, you know, somebody like yourself, you have established yourself as a director. So you have a project, you go take it to a studio. Does it hold a lot more weight because you have all these directing gigs under your belt?
It depends. I mean,
we did it again. Verizon was just named America's most reliable network by Root Metrics for the 16th time in a row, proving once again that nobody builds networks like Verizon builds networks. That's why we're building 5G right. That's why there's only one best network. Verizon. Best and most reliable based on Root Metrics reports from second half 2013 to first half 2021 of three operators on all network types combined, not specific to 5G networks. We did it again. Verizon was just named America's most reliable network by Root Metrics for the 16th time in a row, proving once again that nobody builds networks like Verizon builds networks. That's why we're building 5G right. That's why there's only one best network, Verizon. Best and most reliable based on Root Metrics reports from second half 2013 to first half 2021 of three operators on all network types combined, not specific to 5G networks.
Television is a weird thing because as a TV director, you're kind of a mercenary. You're sort of for hire. If you're in TV, the writers have all the power and then directors have less so. And it's the other way around in movies. So a lot of what I've developed as a director may not have currency as a writer. Now I've had pilots that we've tried to make that I've, you know, co-written or produced, and you know, we try to get made. So I have, you know, been on both sides a little bit, but I've been mostly a director. So TV director also may not have a huge amount of currency in feature films, but I have a track record of telling stories on the screen. So it all depends on what it is. Like, you know, probably not tomorrow I'm going to get a Marvel film, but because of television directing. However, you know, I am a professional studio director. So I have, like, you know, exclusively worked in the studio world for the last 6 years. So everything sort of depends on, like, if I had a passion project that was mine, like, let's say, you know, I've taken one of my scripts and I'm directing it as a feature film and I take it to a studio, they would probably not hesitate to, they wouldn't say, oh, well, can you prove that you can direct this? So I'm already past that. I can prove that I can direct something that's mine for sure, because I've done it. Will someone hire me to do a $50 million feature film? Unlikely. I mean, maybe, but it's unlikely. So it all depends, unless I've made a successful feature film, because they're kind of like different worlds. There's increasing blurring in the line between film and television, because it's like sort of the platinum age of television right now. And so, and arguably some of the most creative stuff is in television. So there's a blurring of the line, but I haven't yet been like so in TV, the primary creative directing, the creative force is the writer. And there's a bunch of writer directors in TV, not a ton of them. And so, you know, if I have a show that I'm the primary creative driving force, then I can, would use that. Everything is sort of like leverage, I guess, in a weird, terrible way to say. But like, if you made something good, then, and you were the creative force behind it, you can get people to pay attention no matter what media or format it is.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I've had...
If you make a great short film, you may not have made a feature film yet, but someone will give you money. Like, you know, Chloe Zhao is nominated now for Best Director. She made a great short film. She made a feature film, and then she made another feature film, and then another feature film. Now she's doing a Marvel film coming up. So
The Eternals,
The Eternals, yeah. So you got to kind of start somewhere anyway.
Right. Sure, I've had female directors who, they're also friends, who've been on here as guests. And this is a question I think mostly usually directed at female directors, but I'll direct this at you also.
Okay.
Has there ever been like a power struggle that who's this brown dude director coming and telling me what to do and how to do it? Has that been ever a thing for you, or have you experienced that, or butting heads with a director, with an actor rather?
Yeah, I don't know if it's because of race. I have a feeling, you know, TV is, I've been lucky. Most of the shows I've worked on have been very professional. I mean, but you do encounter actors who are obstinate for one reason or the other. And it's not, I don't think it's ever been because of who I am. It's more about who they are. Sometimes.
That's right.
You know,
that's
like, right. Sort of like they're kind of the boss. I'm a guest on these shows, although I'm also kind of the boss, but I'm mostly a guest. But, you know, as the guest, if you have someone who's been on that show for many years and plays the main character, he or she knows what they're doing and they have a way they're doing it. But I usually have a way, I don't really butt heads with people generally. And I don't think I have had moments where I just had actors who've just been problematic, and that's, you know, or even sometimes occasionally a crew person is problematic. That doesn't happen as much, but mm-hmm. I don't think it's because of me being a brown filmmaker. It's just me being an outsider. I mean, not being one who's been on the show, or it's because that person thinks they're in charge, which they sometimes are.
Interesting. Yeah, because one of the things I come across talking to female directors is that they're like, they won't listen to me because I'm a female director. Like, they're just
I totally believe that. I mean, it's the thing about a film crew is that it's unfortunate. It's very male focused. It's very like male driven. And,
yes.
You know, I mean, I have not yet worked with a female cinematographer on a television show, which is crazy. And I've directed 30 plus. And that's insane. That's insane to me. I mean, I went to film school with great female cinematographers who are all working now. I just haven't, since film school, have worked with one on a show, which is crazy. So and like most of the crews are men. I mean, almost all the departments are full of men. It's like, it would be harder for, you know, and there are a lot of these men who just won't listen to female directors. It's true. I've worked on a show with a cinematographer who he was fine with me, but he had a reputation of didn't want to work with female directors and wouldn't really listen to them. Either would listen to them, but it was very hard to work with. It was it's really awful. That's one thing that, you know, hopefully we'll continue to get better, but it would require probably even more women on crews. And it also requires from the top. I mean, if you have producers who are very conscious about hiring directors who are professional with whoever they, you know, the crew people who can be professional with whoever, that's most important. Yeah, but I can totally imagine your friends have encountered that. Absolutely. I've seen it. Yeah. I mean, I've seen it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's why I wanted to ask you kind of that portion. I mean, have you ever experienced any kind of weird racism because of what you look on set?
No, not as a director. I think I don't remember. Nothing I remember as a director. Yeah. No. You know what? No one wants to upset the director.
That's right.
You know, so that's true. I don't really get it. So
you're the captain of the ship. They don't want to upset the captain of the ship. But if it's a woman, they don't have a problem upsetting the captain of the ship. How interesting.
Well, they'll hide it and not say, no, no, it's not because he's a woman. It's because of this. And they'll make up some reason. It's not true. But I've never had anything really just from being, I mean, I'm routinely the first Indian to direct a show. I mean, it's because, you know, TV directors skew older than me and they are generally have been white men. So just by the odds, most of the time I go to a show, they have not hired an Indian director before. So, you know, it's not like a big thing, but, you know, I personally have not encountered anyone treating me badly or not listening to me because I'm South Asian, but I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But it has, I'm sure, I don't doubt it hasn't happened before. It's also probably, it happened, it was less, I think everything was less transparent before. Like, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I'm sure it was easier to be a jerk to a black director than it is now, you know? Yeah, so.
Sure.
Even though, though, still no one wants to mess with the director because, like, it's easier to fire a camera assistant than it is to fire a director. So.
Right. I mean, in television, is the director involved in the casting process at all with the top two picks or top three picks or no?
Yeah. So obviously the series regulars are already there. Right. And the main character is already there, but so when I go on a show, there's always guest cast. And so I'm involved in the casting process. I mean, this last year, and the trend recently has been to do it all remotely. Like, you just see audition tapes and then you make choices. I like to do the in-person. I like the shows that Criminal Minds is one that I did that did in-person casting that I love doing that. So usually what happens on most shows, well, Criminal Minds, they would take whatever I wanted to pick, basically. But other shows, I'll narrow down to my top two or three, and then the showrunner, you know, executive producer gets, they say who they want. Usually they try to, the good shows, I say the good shows, the ones that I think are the best creatively, they will consult with the director and they will take the director's choices. Now, if they have a disagreement with the director, they'll say, well, we're concerned, you like this person, but we're concerned about this actor for this reason.
Yeah.
And then I'll have a conversation about it. Sometimes it's as simple as this guest actor looks too much like one of our main characters, which is sometimes has happened. Maybe their audition isn't great, but, you know, because they're playing this in a certain way. But if you think they're good, then, you know, if you think you can get them to this, like, you know, kid actors are always tough too, like younger actors, because, you know, their auditions may not be great. But they kind of look right, or vice versa, their auditions, but they don't look quite right. So then you can feel like, oh, maybe I can work with them. So I usually have a hand in it. And the better shows, I feel like the better shows allow me to do a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm the one who has to direct them later.
Precisely. I mean, are you more of like a hands-off kind of a director? You're like, I've done the good casting. I trust they're going to do the job and just go do your thing. And if there's a slight adjustment, I'll come talk to you.
Yeah. I mean, when I feel casting is usually in the world of TV, so I'll just talk about TV because your own projects are a little bit different, but in TV, the series regulars mostly know what they're doing. You know, they mm-hmm. need maybe some guidance, especially the top, like the people who are the main character, like Kerry Washington didn't need much guidance. You know, like I gave her suggestions and ideas and we would talk about things together, but usually she knew what she was doing. I mean, she obviously always knew what she was doing. The guest cast is where the director does most of their directing. And so that's where I usually do a lot. I like when the actor comes with their own thing and it could be wrong, but I like to see it. I like to see it and then I can help adjust it. I mean, I just was in a situation where we had a very new actor because he's young. He's only 13 or 14. His first show, really. And so, you know, I had to do a lot more of like getting him comfortable, you know, making, you know, really fine tuning and really, you know, really working harder with him because I knew I had to. But, you know, I'll do either. I don't like to talk too much about with the actors because I feel like you get too much in their head. I mean, it also depends. There's also no one size fits all. So some actors who are very accomplished want to be given notes. You know, even some of the series regulars on some shows, they want to be told, was it good? Was it bad? Was there something you can do differently? Is there something you can try differently? There's some actors want to talk about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then some actors just kind of get it and they just say, no, I just want to do one more take. I guess I'll figure it out. And so as the guest director, I kind of have to take the temperature of each person and see what how they like to work. But I don't really, I don't like to over talk because I feel like you can make it worse sometimes.
We're going to start wrapping up, but you touched upon the exact same question, which is what I was going to ask. As a stand-up comic, when we are standing in the back and we're watching the room and the comic, the host goes up and we're like taking the temperature of the room because we have to very quickly adjust what set we're going to do. So we're like, I'm like editing in my brain. I'm like, oh, I'll do this, that, right? But I have to take the temperature of the room or it's just not going to work. Is that the same for you as a director when you show up on set, take a temperature, what's going on? Is this more of a chill crew and cast? This is more, I got to be hands-on. I got to be more stern. Like, is that a thing for you as a director?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, that's more generally when you arrive at a show because a show has a culture and you sort of have to fit into that culture. And some shows are, you very quickly know, you know, who's kind of in charge or who you should listen to, who has good ideas, who has just a lot of ideas, who, you know, and then also then when you get on a crew, you can see how well they, most professional TV shows have a pretty well-oiled machine. Some have been doing it a long time and get lazy, or they just get stuck in their way of doing it and they need a little more prodding to get moving faster or to like try something that seems out of their control. So in some ways, yeah, you do kind of take the temperature of a show. It happens kind of earlier in a way because you get a sense of it when you, like I've worked on some shows that have been on the air for a decade. And so they have some people who've literally been there for 10 years. And so then you get on a show like that, or maybe 15, like in the case of SVU, or now it's 20. You know, on a case like that, they have a way they're doing it and that works. And then they have a way that they're doing it that maybe needs help. And so you just sort of like figure it out. So in some ways, I guess that is one similarity between stand-up, I guess, and being stand-up and being a director, I guess.
Yeah. Like just kind of taking the temperature and be like, all right, you know, I can't be walking in a room and be like, so what are you fuckers up to? Like, and it's like this conservative culture, or they'll be like, crickets, like, oh, that's not gonna work, you know. So you gotta take the temperature. It's not gonna work. It's just not gonna work.
Yeah. Not, like one size doesn't fit all in a lot of circumstances. That's right.
No, I agree. Sure. Are you working currently on any of your personal projects? Is there something we should be on the lookout for?
No, you know, I always have a handful of things that I'm working in. I'm still directing 911 Lone Star right now. I actually have, I'm almost done with this episode. It's going to come out in April. But for my own projects, yeah, I have, gosh. So Valerie and I have two different documentaries that were sort of have been in the works for some time. And then I have a feature film that I'm producing with another South Asian American filmmakers that were just started. So it's not, it's a very early phases. And then I have a lot of projects I'm writing on my own. Next month I'm going back to The Walking Dead. I'm doing a couple episodes of The Walking Dead.
Awesome.
So that's it at the moment.
Awesome. Awesome. Do you like people to stalk you or follow you on social media at all?
Sure. Absolutely. Why not?
what handles do you have that they can follow?
Let's see. I mean, I don't really use, I have an Instagram account. I don't really use it. It's CharithRaju7, and I have a Twitter account.
You mean there are six more with CharithRaju in the world?
It's funny. Someone else said that. Here's a funny thing. I have an email address that I get emails from other Charaths around the world in India. And so I have... But the Twitter, I don't know why. Oh, I did that because I couldn't just put my name, and so I had to pick a number. And I number 7 is a number I've used when I played sports. So
got it. So lucky number 7.
So Twitter, CharithRaju7, and I think that's also my Instagram. And then I have Venmo if someone wants to Venmo money.
Is that CharithRaju7 too, or
no? It's not. It's something else. I can't remember though.
you gotta give the right Venmo, man. If you want to get the cash.
I know that. Well, they may ask for money too, right? Because didn't you request money? I don't want that.
Yeah.
And then Facebook. So.
And then Facebook, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it might not be a good idea to give out your Venmo because God knows you might be getting a money request from me. So
yeah, you got to be careful.
Because I'm like, all right, cool. This director, let me request some cash from him. Sure, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on and doing this chat. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I will talk to you soon. Take care.
Okay, take care.
Bye. That was a lovely chat with Sharat Raju, producer and director. He is going back to directing The Walking Dead. You guys, it is the friggin' weekend. This is a busy weekend. Tonight, right after this, I'm going to be headlining a show online, which is posted on my social media if you want to come and check that show out. Tomorrow, I'm going to be at the Laugh Factory in Hollywood, doing a Stop Asian Hate benefit show at 8 p.m. Pacific. And of course, on Sunday, March 28th, 7 p.m. Pacific, is the debut of my primetime appearance on The Rookie on ABC, which is also on Hulu. You guys, you can subscribe to my channel. That would be awesome. YouTube.com/MonaShake, a comedian, also on TikTok and Facebook with the same name, and Instagram and Twitter at Mona's Comedy. Guys, have a good night. Have a great weekend. I will see you on Monday.
We did it again. Verizon was just named America's most reliable network by Root Metrics for the 16th time in a row, proving once again that nobody builds networks like Verizon builds networks. That's why we're building 5G right. That's why there's only one best network, Verizon. Best and most reliable based on Root Metrics reports from second half 2013 to first half 2021 of three operators on all network types combined, not specific to 5G networks. We did it again. Verizon was just named America's most reliable network by Root Metrics for the 16th time in a row, proving once again that nobody builds networks like Verizon builds networks. That's why we're building 5G right. That's why there's only one best network, Verizon. Best and most reliable based on Root Metrics reports from second half 2013 to first half 2021 of three operators on all network types combined, not specific to 5G networks.